Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This podcast includes discussion of self-harm, suicide and sexual assault. Please listen with care. If you or someone you know needs support, you can contact the Need to Talk helpline anytime, day or night, by texting or calling 1737. A wider list of mental health support services can be found on our show page, www.rnz.co.nz/Nellie's Baby.
Last time on Nellie's Baby.
I don't know how long she was away for. I don't know if she went somewhere else after that. I know there was another place we went to see her at, over the hut somewhere.
They mentioned twice about another child.
I know there was a little baby, and we were worried about a heater with this baby.
I'd like to find a sister.
I'm on hold with births, deaths and marriages at the Department of Internal Affairs. It's been 10 minutes and 42 seconds. This is my third time calling within the space of a week, and at this point I'm starting to wonder if I've fallen down some kind of rabbit hole and ended up in purgatory. I have listened to so much of this hold music that is making me twitchy. And every time I hear the music pause and this message play...
All our agents are currently assisting other callers. Please continue to hold. We thank you for your patience.
I think that someone's picking up and I get excited, only to have my hopes dashed. I'm Kirsty Johnston, and this is Nellie's Baby. Episode 8. I'd like to find a sister. Since we got Nellie's full coronial file, I have spent days, actually months, trying to find out about a potential first baby of Nellie's. The one we think she had when she was about 14. This first baby has always felt like something of a fever dream. Is it real or not? A teenage pregnancy, possibly from some kind of sexual abuse, it seemed like it fit with everything else we knew about Nellie, but until now, the only source we had for this baby's existence was Nellie's sister, Mavis, including what Mavis told Sarah 6 years ago when the two first met.
She was just told that the baby died. That's the earlier adoption.
But it turns out that Mavis was largely going off vague childhood memories of Nellie going away when she was about 14 and Mavis was 9.
I know there was a little baby, I remember this baby, and we were worried about a heater with this baby.
Some of the information also came from Nellie herself.
She's different to my other baby. That's what she'd say, didn't she? Different to my other baby. I don't know if she had imagination or what was going on with her.
And from a curt conversation between Mavis and Nellie's doctor when Sarah was born.
And I said, I believe she might have had a baby before. He said, best leave things alone.
But neither the hospital records from Sarah's birth nor the adoption records had anything further in them about another baby.
It clearly states in there, but it almost states too emphatically. She just has one child. Because apparently she used to talk about her baby all the time. And that's before I was born.
It really wasn't much to go on, but the coronial file changed all of that. After Sarah told me there were repeat mentions of a second baby in the documents, I went back and took another look. It turns out this second baby is actually mentioned 6 times, and it seems to be a girl.
Number of children, 2 girls. Anne-Marie and unknown.
Anne-Marie is Sarah. It's the name Nellie gave her when she was born.
Said she had 2 baby girls. One was Anne-Marie. Her sister fed her. Couldn't remember the other's name.
These are extracts from Nellie's medical file at Elizabeth Memorial, the rest home where she spent the last 6 years of her life. It seems like the staff were asking Nellie questions about her life, both at her original intake and whenever they did annual assessments, and these were the answers that Nellie gave. There's also a mention from Nellie's GP, Tom Farrer, in 2004. Remember when he was arguing for Nellie to have surgery for her prolapsed uterus? He wrote in a letter, "She is said to have 2 children, one in," and here somebody's blanked the date out, and then it says, "one in 1984. A medical cover sheet from Elizabeth Memorial, which was filled out when Nellie went to hospital, had a similar line. Under family history, someone has written, "has had 2 children herself." Again, the date of that first birth is blanked out, and Sarah's birth date is in the second one, 1984. These blank spaces are frustrating. Under the Official Information Act, any redactions are meant to come with notes explaining why things have been blanked out. And there's no such justification here. I mean, I presume it's probably to protect the privacy of this first child, because even though it's Sarah requesting the information, unlike with birth parents or adopted children, the brothers and sisters of a child who was adopted aren't entitled to their family records. They instead face a long court process if they want to access their sibling's file, and they have to even argue that there are special reasons for them to see it. The fact that Nellie mentions the second baby so often and that the file has dates makes me think it must be based on something real. Which is how I ended up listening to this interminable hold music. I really wanted to find out more. But here I am. 10 minutes has now turned into 58 minutes and still no one is picking up.
All our agents are currently assisting other callers. Please continue to hold.
I'm over it. I'm going to call in the experts and check if there's a way to speed up this search.
Thanks for seeing me, because I know you're busy.
I'm visiting Fran Tyler. Remember, Fran is the genealogy investigator who helped interpret Sarah's DNA results.
Nellie, her mum, had another baby when she was maybe 14.
I quickly bring her up to speed on where we're at, that we think there's a sibling, but we've got very little to go on.
That child would have been born in 54-ish.
Yeah. And then Sarah was born in 1984.
I know Fran has a lot of experience with the births, deaths and marriages team, so I ask her if what I'm going through is normal.
And I've spent so long on their hold line.
Oh, yeah. an hour easily. You make a cup of coffee. You keep some coffee warm in the pot because, you know, you're going to go have to go back and get another one before they answer the phone.
And trying to fill out their forms, and I feel like I fill it out and then they come back asking questions that we don't have the answers to.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just send another form. They just keep, because I'm not dealing with the same person each time, so.
Yeah, you have to go back and every time you get somebody new.
What do you do, like how do you deal with them?
With a great deal of patience. They stick by the letter of the law, as they should. They are a government agency and protector of our secrets in some ways. However, birth records are public, so the public should be able to access those and apply for any certificate they want to. But the wording of the legislation makes it quite difficult. You actually have to have the full name of the person that you're searching for. And if you don't have that full name, there is no way of getting that record.
So it seems like even if I did get through on the phone, I wouldn't be allowed the information. So kind of glad that I didn't spend any more time on hold. And on the one hand, it is nice to know that I'm not alone here, but I actually just really want to find those records. And so I ask Fran if there's another way to do it.
Yeah, so 1954, you would need to go and search hard copy birth records. Libraries have them? Some libraries have them?
Hi, where's the reference section?
Yeah. I go to the local library to have a look at birth records.
That's a heated room, so they're in the end. There's librarians there that will help.
Okay, thank you.
I spent absolutely ages searching under births and then later on under deaths. No matter what I did, it was honestly like looking for a needle in a haystack because Wilson is just such a common second name. The last thing I ask Fran about is the unwed mothers' homes operating in the 1950s. This was a time when there was limited access to contraceptives and abortions, but it was also frowned upon for unmarried women to keep babies, so these homes acted as a kind of combination of maternity hospital and adoption agency.
They're all over the country, and normally we've found people would get sent to another town, you know, if the parents are trying to hide that secret. So they'll send them off to another city, which must be quite scary for the girls, you know.
Have you tried to find someone from one of those before?
Yeah, I have a number of occasions, actually. The records are not easy to access.
Okay, is that better? Can you actually
hear you. Okay.
Yep. Okay, cool. Sorry. Okay, yeah. Clear. So, I'm Kirsty Johnston. I'm from Radio New Zealand. Yes. And the story that I'm working on is a podcast.
My last port of call was the agencies that used to run the unmarried mothers' homes. I rang the biggest ones I could find, but it was like Fran said. They were kind of impenetrable.
So if you could please send me an email with your request, then I'll follow up on that for you.
But yeah, will you be able to help me, do you think, like look into whether her mum was in one of your guys' homes?
I will not be doing that, but the staff who, you know, do and look into that can advise, you know, what information they're allowed to give.
The most promising lead was a place initially called the Alexandra Home for Friendless Women, which was set up in 1879 by the Wellington Ladies Christian Association. The name was later changed to the Alexandra Home for Unmarried Mothers, which I guess is better than being friendless. But anyway, the records are now in the care of another charity called the House of Grace.
Hello, House of Grace. Carleen speaking.
Oh, hi, Carleen. My name's Kirsty. How are you?
I'm good, Kirsty. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, I'm looking for Rebecca Banks.
The Alexandra Home was a private maternity home in Newtown, the suburb where Nellie grew up. It took a few calls back and forth, but I finally ended up speaking to someone who knew how to access the records.
So the House of Grace is only 21 years old, so the information that you're seeking comes from the Alexander Turnbull Library. It's got all the history.
Oh, cool. So I could look that up.
Yeah.
The records were apparently at the Alexander Turnbull Library at National Archives. We got permission to search them, but again, we couldn't find Nellie's name. To be fair, this whole thing was a long shot. Remember that Mavis said that when Nellie went away, she actually went to Te Tahi Bay. That's a suburb near Porirua, right north of Wellington. But we couldn't find any records of a mother's home there. It is possible that, instead, Nellie actually stayed at a private home. At that time, some families took in young pregnant women as live-in help, like having a maid, until they had their babies. And, of course, there'd be no records of that. I ring Fran to tell her what I've found.
So I just don't know with the sibling, like, I kind of, yeah, I feel like I've reached the end of my...
Yeah, well, if you don't know the name that that child was born in, it's almost impossible. You're really then back to the DNA results, hoping to give you a match.
The DNA, as far as I'm concerned, is another dead end. Nellie's first child would share about half of Sarah's DNA, and we couldn't find anyone on Ancestry.com who was that close a match.
Maybe they'll hear the podcast. Maybe this little sibling will hear the podcast
and know.
Recognise themselves.
Even as I'm saying this, I can hear how far-fetched it sounds. I guess I just want a little bit of hope that it might still happen someday. At this point, I feel a little bit like I've failed Sarah. There are still some big questions about Nellie's life that I don't know if we really resolved. I have this nagging feeling that if only we'd got her notes from Porirua Hospital, those 6 volumes that we know exist and just can't convince the authorities to hand over because what they say are privacy issues, that if we got them, that they would hold the answers. But then, I think some of the questions that I lie awake at night thinking about are more challenging than whether or not Nellie had a first baby, or the exact specifics of her admission to Porirua, or even her diagnosis, although I do still have some questions about that. What I'm really struggling to come to terms with is how to feel about Nellie's treatment. The way she was treated by her doctors, by the staff at Porirua, by society. You know, she was locked up for hours on end. She was given cigarettes as bribes. She was forced to have electric shock treatment. She was put on drugs with all of these horrendous side effects. The whole thing just feels wrong. And I also wonder, are things really any better now? Like, would Nellie's life trajectory really be any different today? Would she have been allowed to keep Sarah or be involved in her life?
In a different way, we're still doing this today. It is common today for our child services to remove children from parents with an intellectual disability on the grounds that they wouldn't be able to parent that child adequately themselves.
This is Dr. Olive Webb. She's a clinical psychologist who worked at Sunnyside, a mental asylum in Christchurch, for more than 20 years. I've called her for help. She's one of New Zealand's most respected experts in the field of disability and institutionalisation. In fact, her research was a major factor in closing the large psychiatric hospitals because of the concerns she raised about patients being mistreated. And you might actually remember Dr. Webb's voice from an earlier episode. She gave evidence to the Royal Commission about her time at Sunnyside.
Hand on heart, I have not seen an individual staff person being cruel, but the systems in which everybody lived and worked were terribly cruel.
So, would Nellie be able to keep her own baby now?
I think we have a more sanitised version of this nowadays, but still the presumption that people with disabilities cannot and should not raise their own children is a sort of a default position. And I guess my response to that, if you want me to go on, is that it is very unusual for parents to raise children alone. There's always cousins and aunts and grandparents and friends. And, you know, we live, you know, it's the village, as it were, that raises the child. There is lots and lots of experiences where parents who have intellectual disabilities love their baby, and it's not that hard to create or enlist, as it were, a live-in nanny who does the jobs, but nobody can replace that loving relationship between parent and child.
Obviously, a big question even today around Nellie's ability to raise a child would be her diagnosis and the severity of her mental health issues. And that's still a bit of a mystery for us. Did she really have schizophrenia, or was it something else? Dr. Webb says without the notes, it's impossible to know because of the way diagnoses were made back then.
Back in the 70s when I was training, it was relatively easy to diagnose schizophrenia because these were people who had a disturbance of perception. So they heard voices, they saw things that weren't there and stuff like that. And so if somebody ticked those boxes, then they were considered to be schizophrenic. All these years later, life is not as simple as that. We know, for example, that people who have been severely traumatized may have disorders of perception and cognition and belief systems and all the rest of it. What we all also know more about now that we didn't know then is the huge impact of anxiety. So people can switch off, they can dissociate, they look as if they're in a trance. What is happening to them is that they're in an acute state of anxiety. And it doesn't mean that they have become psychotic. So what I'm saying is to know that somebody back in the 60s was diagnosed as being schizophrenic, really all it tells us is that she was disturbed.
To be honest, I don't even know how important this diagnosis is. It seems that given her symptoms, Nellie would initially have been treated the same way, no matter what medical label she was given. Dr. Webb says the beliefs of the time, the presumed Christian morality, the colonialism, the patriarchy, basically governed how people were treated. But she also makes a link that I hadn't made before between Nellie's lifelong institutionalization, her being forced to take contraceptives, and the removal of her baby or perhaps two babies. That link is the eugenics movement.
So it was important when there were people who were considered to be somehow impaired or not properly human to be segregated and kept away. Their segregation was rationalized because, and I quote, they'll be happy with their own kind. Now, in my experience of 50 years working in the intellectual disability sector, I have never found anyone in an institution who didn't regard their stay there as being temporary. Some of them have been there for 50 years, but still regarded it as temporary. There was some research done at Sunnyside back in the 80s and when the Adeance movement was starting to get underway. And they asked discharged patients who had gone into the community residential services if they would rather live in the cold, drafty, hideous boarding houses that sprung up and all the rest of it, or if they would rather live in warm, good food, Sunnyside Hospital. And they all chose the first because that's about them being in control of their experiences. And I mean, as I've talked, I've been mindful of, you know, in one of the wards that I managed back in 1970, a ward doctor was looking at somebody had cut their hand or something like this. And he said, I know that you and I would find that very painful. Do you think they really feel the pain the same as we do? And this was the norm.
When Dr. Webb said this, the penny dropped. Suddenly, that word we've been hearing, systemic, made sense to me. Because Even though there were moments where individuals were kind and caring throughout Nellie's story, what she was trapped in was a belief system that treated people like her as less than regular people. And I guess if you take that further, that's what justifies shutting them away and removing their dignity and their autonomy.
This is why something like the commission needs not to be a one-off event. There are still people who believe that she and they are not worth a greater investment. It's not just about doing things right, it's actually about doing the right thing. But what is nice, and to me, Nellie's, the story that Nellie's daughter can tell is about her, A, wanting to know about who her mother was and what she was and all of that sort of thing, but then this quite apparent respect that she has for her, regardless of how she had been, you know, incarcerated for 40 or 50 years, virtually all her life, and to take up the cudgels on behalf of the Nellies of the world, because there are lots of people who fit into that category.
Hello.
It's now December 2023, more than a year after Sarah and I first talked, and almost a year since that trip to Wellington where we met Sharon and Gordon and Tracy and Mavis.
I just realised I'm wearing my my jangly things.
Sarah's in the UK and I'm in my office at home. This phone call feels weirdly similar to our very first one. Sarah's even wearing her armloads of bracelets. I actually feel a little bit nervous because I finally decided to call time on my search for Sarah's possible sister, and so this will be the last step in this journey. Well, for me anyway. And I really want to know what it's been like for Sarah. How does she feel about Nellie's treatment, and is she glad we found out more about her birth mother? I guess I just really want to know, has it all been worth it for her or not? And the thing is, I know this might be an especially difficult thing to talk about because just a few months after meeting her biological father, Gordon, Sarah's adoptive father actually died, and she only just managed to get back to New Zealand to see him before he passed.
It was a big year. It was a big year because obviously you meet sort of like I gained a father and lost a father in 1 year. It's quite, yeah, it was a very emotional year. And also finding out all that stuff about Nellie. And of course, originally when I contacted you, it was because I was like, this can't be right, you know, like reading that autopsy. But I was pleased, obviously, when you found out that there was an inquest, that people did look into it at the time. I still think there were a lot of unanswered questions with that, but, you know, at least it was shown that someone did care enough to look into it.
Sarah's disappointed that we haven't managed to track down her sibling, but she says there's still names within the family tree from her DNA test that she thinks could lead somewhere.
Someone in those names will know who that sister is. I think she did, who my sister is. I think she did survive. Whether the baby did die or not, no one seems to know. But I think if the baby had died, it wouldn't have been on her mind as much, maybe, or I don't know.
What are your thoughts now, like your kind of lingering feeling about what Nellie's life was actually like?
I think it was probably a nice childhood, but then after that, you know, from her breakdown, just probably quite tortured, really. I mean, definitely listening to what Gordon said about the punishments and knowing from other cases what happened in those institutions. So it probably wasn't great, but maybe she was just so detached from, dissociated from her body that she wasn't really aware. That's what I can hope. She wasn't that aware of when things were bad for her.
Yeah, I think I'm like you. I try to look for the light points in the story, but
There's not many. Yeah, there's not that many, really.
Do you think Nelly had a better life after leaving Porirua?
No, 100% not. I think it would just be, I think she was so institutionalised. Whereas I think Gordon had, he had more of a chance when they shut it down because he can, you know, go for a walk by himself and get home by himself. Whereas I don't think from the sound of Nelly that she would have been capable of doing that. So I don't think there ever would have been a de-institutionalised for her. The care home that we put her in was just another care home, really. It's just another Porirua.
Do you think it's better to know what happened to them? Like, are you happy that we did this?
Oh, yeah, definitely better. I always knew, you know, that it's going to rake up some memories, you know, not only for my adopted parents, but also for the family. I mean, obviously, it can only be a good thing, I think, meeting my father's side of the family. But probing perhaps into her death or bringing up her death and obviously speaking to Mavis and bringing up some memories there might have affected them a bit, but I still think it was a good thing, you know, and it was sort of like it was a nice journey. For me, it was really, really important. And for me, meeting my birth mother's side of the family, first of all, you know, it was one of the first times I felt like I had like a place in the world that I was wanted. And of course, my adopted parents always wanted me. But it was knowing that I wasn't rejected. Because I think you just grow up thinking that you're just not wanted, that you were rejected. So hearing that they did want me and they wanted the best for me, which is why they put me with the best family they possibly could, I think that was quite a good closure for me and a healing thing. And then also I always thought I might have been the product of a rape. Because after that, when I found out she was in the institution for so long and so many years, then I thought, oh gosh, you know, has someone taken advantage of her? Has, you know, is it a doctor? Is it someone who worked there who's, you know, raped her, basically? But knowing that it was Gordon and another patient actually does make me feel a lot better.
In this moment, I agree with what Mavis said that day when we met her. Nelly is lucky to have a daughter like Sarah. Someone so caring, who approached her story with empathy and without judgment. But Sarah says that actually she feels like she's the lucky one.
She gave me like the gift of life, really. So that I'm very grateful to her and to be in touch with her family. So she was 45 and on contraception. And from all accounts, I think they only really, Gordon only talked about that one incident near the pool. How did he describe it? It wasn't making love or anything. It was like having a naughty, that was it, having a naughty by the pool. I don't know how she got me, but obviously maybe I was meant to come here. You know, some people say that your soul chooses the path or chooses the life that you're born into. So maybe I just chose a particularly interesting path to come down to.
It feels sad to have to say goodbye to Sarah. On a personal and professional level, it's been such a privilege to get to know her and to learn from her, really. I love how Sarah has this incisive, analytical mind, but how she also strives to see the best in people and in situations. It's a long way from the typically cynical mindset you usually encounter in journalism. I'm also sad to say goodbye to Nelly. In the last year, she's been a constant presence in my life. And in a way, I felt like I've got to know her too. from such scant beginnings, we really learned so much. That she was committed to Porirua by doctors and basically left there her whole life. She did have a schizophrenia diagnosis, but it was complicated by her intellectual disability and later by her extreme institutionalization. We learned she had a child with Gordon, a miracle child really, and maybe she had another child, maybe with this mystery man behind the statue, or maybe with someone else, or maybe she did imagine it all, but I don't think so. We learned that she wasn't murdered, but her death was, is, still tragic in another way, a culmination of years of trauma inflicted on her mind and her body by the state. We also learned that Nellie was more than all of these awful things that happened to her. She was funny. She was mischievous. She was loved. I like to think of her at her happiest. Living with her mum, a cat on her lap, having a sugary, lukewarm cup of tea, laughing her cheeky laugh. Thanks for listening to Nellie's Baby. If you liked this program, make sure to follow or subscribe using your favourite podcast app or listen ad-free at rnz.co.nz. While you're there, you can browse RNZ's excellent range of podcasts like Dear Wars, Conviction and The Detail, our daily news podcast. You can also find a whole lot of Nellie's Baby's extras, including feature articles, photographs and bonus podcasts at our show page, rnz.co.nz/Nellie's Baby, and that's Nellie spelled N-E-L-L-I-E.
Nellie's Baby is presented by Kirsty Johnston. The executive producer is Tim Watkin and the executive editor is John Hartevelt. The producers are William Ray and Justin Gregory. The sound engineers are Phil Benge, William Saunders and Mark Chesterman. The production coordinator is Brianna Juritich. Special thanks to Dr. Hilary Stace and Dr. Olive Webb for their help in producing this podcast, and extra special thanks to Sarah.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.